Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
That's going to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh, he's there.
Kane is the record.
Here's Lucas Moura.
Oh, they've done it.
I'm loving big engines instead.
Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to our latest edition of the Tottenham Way podcast. I'm Marcus Buckland in the company of the Allnut. That is Tom Allnut from The Times and Danny Boy, Dan Kilpatrick of the Evening Standard. And this week we are going to broach the subject of Harry Kane possibly failing to claim any silverware in Germany following Bayern's hammering at the hands of Leverkusen on Saturday. How will Spurs fans feel about that? How should Spurs fans feel about that? Do we still have a 0.1% chance of winning the Premier League title following the latest round of fixtures? Is Ange close to knowing his best starting 11? Just about everybody's back. But of course, you've got to get the formula right. And how good was it to see Son back in action at the weekend? And making the decisive pass, of course, in the 96th minute to win the game. Super Sonny, what drama. You cannot leave a Spurs game early at the moment, that is for sure. Tom, Dan, good to see you both. Let's just start with a few more words about the Brighton game. You came up with a terrific review immediately afterwards. The one thing that struck me, actually, about that game and the response thereafter is the very mixed views that have come in. There are some who say, well, look at the stats. Spurs have plenty of chances. They probably just about deserved it. There were others, and I'm one of those, who watched the game live and thought Brighton were really impressive and probably deserved to win. There were two moments in the second half from my position where I was convinced they'd scored a second goal. And then there are others who are saying a draw was probably just about right. And I certainly wouldn't quibble with any of those. But it was one of those matches where the stats are perhaps a little bit deceptive. And where certainly for a 25-minute period in the second half, after that triple substitution, Spurs were completely out of it. Brighton dominated. And that brings on a subject in itself. So, Dan, if I just start with you. I mean, my one criticism perhaps of Postecoglou in that game is that he made the three changes, he was going to make them, and then Spurs scored. Now, to me, and you know, I know nothing, but I thought at that point he might just have held back, bring Son on, but Spurs had a grip of things. And Kulusevski, I thought, was doing a really good job early in the second half. Do you think, just in that instance, first of all, he should have been a little bit more flexible with regards to those subs?
Hi, Marcus. Yeah, we spoke about this in quite a lot of detail on the reaction pod, so I'm just going to repeat myself, but I do think it's a really interesting debate and worth going over again, particularly if anyone hasn't listened to that reaction pod. The subs ultimately worked because Son combined with Johnston in the last minute, but I certainly felt watching the game that Spurs completely ceded control of the match and kind of the balance of the team as well by making that triple change. You know, Kulusevski had the right side held down, like really locked down. He had the beating of Estupinan and he was playing really, really well since half time. And Spurs just were in the ascendancy. You know, the goal wasn't really a surprise. It was what they deserved for the way they played since half time. And then suddenly that all went out the window. And maybe that was a reaction from Brighton to going a goal down. You know, I'm sure there was an element of that. You know, it gave them a kick up the arse. But I think the changes just didn't help Spurs. You know, they lost the control. They lost that kind of focal point that Kulusevski was giving them on the right. And, you know, suddenly it felt like they couldn't hold the ball up and couldn't really build from the back. So it was strange in that the subs didn't feel like they had worked for a good sort of 20, 30 minutes, which prompted Postecoglou to turn to Højbjerg and Skip, which, you know, is quite a drastic call for a very attacking manager to bring on two holding midfielders. In the end, it was just Højbjerg because Udogi had to go off. But yeah, that told a big story of sort of how Spurs were struggling. But the kind of end result was the subs changing the game and you know, a masterstroke from the bench. And you know, as we said on the reaction pod, that kind of shows the the fine margins at that level.
Ultimately, in whatever line of work you're in, you'd rather be lucky than good. And there was a little bit of good fortune. And you talk about a masterstroke. And Tom, you made this point in the immediate reaction. It's not exactly a touch of genius to bring Son on from the bench. And he had the final say. And I just thought it was great to see him back. You know, I thought he was sharp. I wondered, obviously, how he was. I know how he's feeling after what happened to South Korea. So it was going to be very, very tough to get himself back up. But from the moment he came on, there was energy. There was that commitment. And I think it's very easy to underestimate the quality of that ball in the 96th minute, which led to the winning goal, particularly when we'd seen so many poor deliveries. And I'm not going to hammer Timo Werner, but it does get frustrating. It takes me all the way back to Rule Fox years and years ago, who had the flying pace and would get himself into countless brilliant positions and then cross the bloody ball into row Z behind the goal. But, I mean, Sonny, what more can we say about the great man, Tom?
Have we had a draft yet with Rule Fox? I don't think he's been... I'm not sure he's been picked by anyone, has he?
He's no Gylfi Sigurdsson.
He's not in my team straight away. Telling you that, he's never getting in my 11.
Gylfi Sigurdsson, yeah. I agree. I think Sonny's delivery was really good. And I think it is easy to underestimate that kind of ability to do that. You know, on the run with his left foot. And not just that, but with 10 seconds to go. You know, I think there are so many players who they can see the clock, the players, and know exactly where they are in added time. For him to produce that with the pace, you know, I think it would have been quite easy to kind of put a percentage cross in just to sort of do the job and hope for the best. But he wasn't looking to do that. He was really looking to make sure he evaded Brighton keeper, Brighton defenders, and get it to Johnson at the back post. I thought it was a moment of real quality. I'm interested. I mean, I was writing about this on Monday, and it's very clear to me that Tottenham basically post 90 minutes are the most chaotic team in the league, you know, for good and for bad. You know, you look at the stats here, which our friendly statisticians provided for us, you know, and points won, they've won 8 points, which is the most in the league post 90 minutes. Points lost, they've lost 5 points after 90 minutes, which is second in the league. They've conceded the most goals after 90 minutes in the league, and they've scored the second most. So they're right up there. You know, in injury time, there's no team that is more unpredictable, more exciting, whatever you want to call it, you know. And, you know, net, they've gained 3 points in after 90 minutes. So they are 3 points up, you know. So if we zoom out here a little bit, you know, yes, this game obviously went for them. But I think what we're all kind of admitting is that on the balance of play, it could have gone either way. You know, Brighton had some really good chances in that 70 minutes sort of period up to 90. And I think that's why it's difficult to kind of say who deserved to win, because it was one of those games where it just was end to end. Both teams were robbing each other of the ball. It wasn't really about kind of who's on top, who's not on top. It was more about we've pressed you really well, nicked the ball off your defence, and now we've got a chance, you know, and that happened over and over again in the game. And I guess what I'm interested in with this kind of late goals thing, is it because Spurs are naive, fragile, lack a little bit of stability and control? Or is this actually the Ange approach? You know, is this very much part of his thing? We roll the dice, we try and score another goal, whether we're 1-0 up or 1-0 down. And to some extent, if that is the case, then I kind of say fair play. You know, if this is part of the kind of Spurs way, the Ange way, that, you know, we don't accept 1-1. You know, we go for 2-1 and that might mean we lose 2-1, but we might win 2-1. You know, and it's all about excitement and playing to win. Then fair enough, you know. But equally, I wonder if the Ange Spurs next season or even in the season after might be a slightly more mature, slightly more stable, if I dare say it, a slightly more pragmatic team. And we might see a bit less of this. But for now, you know, they're just about on top, I guess, you know, plus 3 points. And you know, it's fun to watch.
Those are terrific stats. And I agree with you. I think it's the result of the Ange way. The one thing that got to me and to my fellow supporters on Saturday is this continued insistence to play out from the back, particularly when you're up against a team like Brighton, who were pressing so high and making Spurs look incredibly fragile. Every time Vicario had the ball, I'm hiding my eyes, waiting to see who he's going to pass to, facing his own goal. you know, I know why it's been done and everybody's trying to do it. And when you're a really good team against the right opposition, it's fantastic. But I do feel there needs to be more of a plan B in that regard, Dan. I don't know if that's an aspect of the Spurs performance that caught your eye on Saturday, but it was giving me kittens.
I've got to say, Marcus, I feel like you're a bit of an old man yelling at clouds here. I mean, I just think we've had this debate, right? Like, we know it's a high-risk approach, but I think it's also been established that this is the way you've got to play now in the Premier League and that the rewards do outweigh the risks. I think Tom made a good point in the reaction pod, which is that Spurs and perhaps Brighton as well, although I haven't seen as much of Brighton, obviously, are not fully up to speed with playing out from the back yet. You know, there's still kinks to iron out in their approach. And that's not surprising because last season they weren't doing that under Conte. You know, they were playing a pretty different way. So this very high risk, very kind of puritanical way of playing out will take some time to hone, particularly given that Romero and Van de Ven, who are the two most important elements of it, have had a big chunk of the season on the sidelines. But I think it's the right way to play. You know, we know that all the top managers are doing this and they're doing it for a reason because it ultimately is worth it. And I think probably Spurs are going through their kind of learning sort of transitional period where they're still refining it. And you know, again, to Tom's point, we'll probably see a much more polished version of this next season. But I think while it is pretty hairy, it's just kind of something that supporters have to sort of live with and embrace, I think. I remember when Pochettino was trying to do a similar thing at Spurs in his kind of first couple of seasons, and he said in an interview that when his players were playing out, he could feel the crowd starting to panic sometimes. But he knew that his players were panicking when Lloris started booting it long to Kane. That's when he knew panic had set into his team. So it was kind of like the reverse effect between the crowd and players. And I feel like Postecoglou would probably feel the same way. You know, if Vicario started hoofing it toward sort of Sonny and Richarlison every time he got it, I think that would be a sign that Spurs were kind of out of sorts and panicking. Whereas when they're continuing to play out and follow his instructions, it sort of shows that they're sort of still got their heads in the game.
Well, you're quite right. I'm an old man and I am screaming to the clouds, but I think one of my biggest cheers towards the end of the game on Saturday was when Vicario did boot it long. I think it led to a pretty good counter-attack as well. So I think there's just moments when perhaps you can say, all right, we know what we should be doing and we'll continue to work on it. But just for now, we're going back to the old Wimbledon of the 80s, Route 1 style, just to alleviate a bit of the pressure for the fans, if not the players. But as you talk about the development of the team and everything else, I've got my pen and paper. I wonder how close Postecoglou is to knowing his best starting 11. He's got just about all the pieces there. Man of Solomon's had a little bit of a setback, but I don't suppose he would make many people's first choice 11. And well, as for Ryan Sessegnon, we'll say no more at the moment. But I'm going to see how close the three of us, based on what we saw last weekend and assuming that everybody is available now for the remainder of the season, what do we feel? And what does Postecoglou feel to be his best starting 11? And presumably, guys, you know, the defence does pick itself. No one's quibbling with the goalkeeper or the four defenders, but it's exactly how you deploy your other talents. So, Tom, if I can start with you, and we've got issues, you know, should it be Bissouma? Should it be Bentancur? This, that and the other. Should Sonny play down the middle? Do we keep faith with Richarlison? Where does Werner play? I know it's a difficult one, but based on what you know of Postecoglou as well, what do you feel is his best 11? What does he feel, do you think, at this point is his best starting 11?
I mean, I think it's a slightly boring answer, but I do think it sort of depends on who they're playing. And it clearly depends on form and fitness, all these kind of things. And it's worth saying that I think the sort of the idea of a best 11 now, it is a little bit kind of outdated. You know, what is Manchester City's best 11? I mean, I couldn't name it. I have no idea what their best front five is. You know, they play them not only different players but in different positions every single week, you know. And so I think in a way the kind of strength of a squad, and that is basically what we're talking about here, is when it gets difficult to know, you know. And if you do know your best 11 and exactly who that is, then maybe your team isn't quite deep enough, you know. And Spurs have those options now. I guess at this current time I thought Bissouma really showed at the weekend what he does bring to the team when he's kind of at it, you know. And I love Bentancur, and I think it was a funny game for him because he obviously made the mistake for the goal, for the penalty. But then also it was his kind of quick feet and courage and bravery on the ball which led to the winner, I think, you know, in midfield. So, I mean, I think, you know, when Bentancur is playing well, I think he's one of the best players in the league at what he does. So I don't know if I would really want to choose between them because I sort of think you would just pick them based on form. Who would I pick this weekend? I think I'd probably pick Bissouma because I think Bentancur is slightly still gaining his sharpness back, you know. So at the moment, I would probably say the best three is Bissouma, Sarr and Maddison because I think it's easy to kind of overlook Sarr because you think you want all the ball players, you want all the nice kind of, you know, through balls and the people who can pass. But Sarr provides so much for this team in terms of his energy and his running and what he does in both boxes. And I think as well with his, you know, the ball at his feet, you know, his sometimes his passing is so good. You know, he moves it so quickly and forward so quickly as well. He gets his head up early and keeps that tempo and pace that Spurs play with. So that would probably be my three for the kind of current moment. But, you know, these things are so kind of fluid. And then up front, I wouldn't have Werner anywhere near it, I've got to say. Not to kind of, I don't know, I don't want to, you know, take against Timo, but I just think he's an add-on to this squad, in my opinion. I know Tom Barkley is a huge Timo Werner fan, so he'll probably be shaking at this. But I would have Son left, Richarlison down the middle, and Kulusevski.
He's really interesting, Werner, and I watched him closely. And there were moments I thought on Saturday against Brighton where we saw that lightning pace and the fantastic control. Close control that sees him skip past two or three players and then you're just waiting for a fantastic shot into the top right-hand corner and it doesn't come. And then you go back to the Timo, who I think is panicking about being offside, so hold the ball up, look for the easy pass, and when he does break through, he just can't get that ball across. I mean, I'd like to see him play down the right more and give him an opportunity to try and whip the ball in with his proper foot. So for me, though, and I think it's what you've said there, Tom, is so important. It is all about having a good squad. And Werner and Johnson at the moment strike me as being perfect substitutes, people to bring on when you want a bit of pace, when you want to change things around early in the second half. So actually, that 11 that you've named, although Kulusevski is a bit of a quandary, Dan, for me as well. You were full of praise, rightly, for him at the weekend. I still don't quite think he's functioning at 100%. So he intrigues me as a player because I think he's got the ability to be absolutely outstanding. But for whatever reason, is it fair to say that although he does a good job, he's not delivering to the extent that a team with a 0.1% chance of winning the title requires?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I find Kulusevski strange. He can have these periods of the game where he's phenomenal, as we spoke about, you know, the first 20 minutes of the second half against Brighton. And then he can have spells where he just feels a bit anonymous. It doesn't feel like he's kind of using his weapons as much as he has done in the past. I feel like he's not shooting as much as he was. I remember against Chelsea in November, he scored that deflected goal very early, didn't he? Where he just kind of stepped inside and had a shot. And I think he seems to be doing that less this side of the new year, maybe. And I'd like to see him use that left foot and kind of step inside and whip those crosses in as he did for Richarlison quite recently and have more shots. But he is a young player, Kulusevski. I think that's easy to forget because he doesn't really carry himself like a young player. And he was so good when he first came to the league. But I think Spurs are in a position now where they have got competition for places. You know, Johnson's come off the bench a couple of times and scored, and that's really positive. And Werner, I'm not sold on him either, but, you know, he has already got a couple of assists under his belt and, you know, clearly he's a decent squad player, if not more, for Spurs. So that's the position they want to be in. It felt for the whole of last season, really, that Kulusevski was a lock in that front three. And, you know, it's not healthy or positive for any side to have players that are kind of guaranteed starting places. So I guess to sum up, I agree with Tom wholeheartedly, as boring as that is. You know, it is a squad game. It kind of depends who they're playing. For me, the best 11 comes down to Bissouma or Bentancur at the moment. And I would give it to Bissouma based on the fact that I think Bentancur is still getting up to speed and looks, you know, a little bit hesitant when kind of really pressed at the base of midfield. And then two positions in the front three, I think, still up for grabs. Probably Richarlison has done enough to kind of hold down one for most of the rest of the season. And then it depends who kind of you want to play with him and Son. I would still give it to Kulusevski because I think he brings something different. But I do, you know, like what Johnson's been doing from the bench recently. Obviously, attacking that far post and obviously finishing, you know, well against Brentford and Brighton.
Well, the good thing, of course, is that there are options and they're good options, and we haven't really been in that sort of position for quite a long time. Just touching on Richarlison briefly once more, and we said so much about him, and yeah, his work rate's fantastic. He has scored enough goals of late to warrant a starting place. But I'll echo what you said at the weekend. When it's an instinctive opportunity for him, as was demonstrated by those two goals at Everton, he's a brilliant finisher. When he's got time to think about what he's doing, then I worry. And there was evidence of that at the weekend. And I do think that when he's playing with Maddison, and Maddison's going to thread those balls through to him, he's going to get chances, quite a lot of chances, I think, where he has a bit of time to decide what to do. And that's where I've got a question mark about him being the long-term answer. There aren't many brilliant instinctive finishers, but when you've got somebody like Maddison threading the ball through on a plate for you, you do need somebody, I think, like that to fully capitalise. But anyway, we'll see if we are spot on with Bissouma getting a nod in the 11 to play Wolves at the weekend. And we'll touch on that shortly. Wolves are a bit of a bogey team for us at the moment. Quickly, Tom, on the subject of Postecoglou and his future, and it seems ridiculous even to be mentioning this after a few months of what's been a brilliant start to his career at Spurs. But there have been a couple of articles reminding us all that he's a Liverpool fan at heart and there's a vacancy on Merseyside in the summer. Should we pay attention to any of these scurrilous bits of journalism?
I mean, I guess it's worth saying that, you know, that this is kind of what happened with Pochettino, that in the first year or two, Tottenham and Tottenham fans are wondering, is he the right man for us? And then after two or three years, other clubs were thinking, is he the right man, you know, to come and manage our team? You know, that's sort of the sign of a manager that is doing a good job. And there's no doubt that Andy is doing a great job at Spurs. It's worth saying, I think, that Spurs are very confident that Ange won't be going anywhere in the summer. He has a contract which is heavily incentivized, which means that he's going to get, you know, some pretty hefty rewards for potentially getting Spurs in the Champions League, for example. And I think more than that, I think just sort of psychologically for Postecoglou, you know, this is the job for him at this moment. You know, coming to the Premier League was a huge step in his career. It was a massive vindication of the work he's done elsewhere. And I don't think he would want to kind of jump ship at this point. You know, he really is just kind of getting going. So I also think with Liverpool, I think they will be looking elsewhere. You know, I think Ange might be on their kind of short list, you know, top five or something, but I don't think he's going to be in their top two or three. You know, there's Xabi Alonso, for example, that everyone knows is basically, you know, a shoe-in right now, it seems. I think maybe the greater threat is City, you know, just in terms of the links that they have with Postecoglou, the way he plays, but also the timing, I think, just might be slightly better and slightly more worrying for Tottenham, in the sense that if Guardiola sees out his current contract, then he would be leaving end of next season. And perhaps, you know, look into our crystal ball, maybe Spurs have a great season next season, finish second or something, win a trophy, then maybe Ange, after 2 years, might think that he's you know, done his job. I still think it's early. I still think it's unlikely. But that, I think, is slightly more of a concern than the Liverpool job this summer.
Yeah, I was about to say exactly the same thing. I'm not actually entirely convinced that Liverpool post-Klopp, particularly with Salah, Van Dijk and Alexander-Arnold all out of contract in 18 months and a new sporting director to come in. You know, they're a club that is headed for a period of transition, inevitably. And whether a new manager can kind of ride that out and keep them at the top, I think it is very questionable as it stands. So I'm not convinced that Liverpool, at the start of next season, you know, following this absolute legend in Klopp, is necessarily a more attractive job than Spurs after, you know, another positive summer window, you know, assuming that happens. Spurs aren't a million miles away from Liverpool at the moment. You know, there's clearly a gap, but I think part of that immediately gets bridged when kind of Klopp walks away, particularly if they're struggling to keep Salah and Van Dijk, which seems kind of very, very possible as it stands. City, for me, as Allnut said, are a bigger threat. It's just a club that, again, will have a period of transition post-Pep, you imagine, but is just kind of so well set up for a head coach to walk in and basically run the first team and let the, you know, very, very well-paid administrators run everything else, that it would be tempting for a kind of training ground coach like Postecoglou. Although that said, you know, we know that, you know, Ange likes to have a say on transfers. You know, he likes to be influential in kind of setting the culture at the club. So actually, would that suit him? I don't know. I mean, I think it would be hard to say no to City. But on the flip side, in Tom's scenario, you know, Spurs did finish second. Let's say they finished second to City next season. Then surely he would be thinking, well, hold on, there's now an incredible opportunity to go one better with Spurs because Guardiola's, you know, leaving City and he's been the difference over the last 7, 8, 9 years. So who knows? But yeah, Spurs should be confident of keeping him.
Also, no one wants to be in charge of City when the Premier League charges come in. You know, I mean, the City job could be a League Two job next, you know, this time next year. Who knows? You know, so I think least of all Ange, you know, the kind of puritanical football person he is, I don't think he wants to be dealing with those kind of questions.
Well, that's exactly the point I was going to make. Hopefully City will be playing in the conference in a year or two and he's not going to drop down that far. Liverpool are going to be struggling because Klopp has gone. Arteta will have taken his celebration runs all the way to Barcelona, and Spurs will be the power in the land. Now, you touched on Xabi Alonso, which just takes us on a slight detour to a former Spurs player, the ultimate Spurs player. Harry, of course, left in the summer to win silverware. And as things stand in the Bundesliga at the moment, he is not going to be part of the domestic champions. They're off the pace. They were hammered by Leverkusen. And this led to lots of inevitable ribaldry in social media and everywhere else, you know, how Spursy are buying this, that and the other. It's very, very boring. But the thing that I don't get this, but I know Dan's got a strong point on it. There seems to be a lot of Spurs fans who are loving the fact that Harry might not win anything. And to me, I mean, that's just sad. The guy did everything for us. And frankly, if he does go and win something quickly, I think there's more chance that he might come back while there's still some power in his boots and win something for us. So Dan, try to explain to me why so many Spurs fans seem so happy that Harry might miss out again.
Well, for kind of background, the reason we put this on the running order is because me, Tom Barkley and Tom Allnutt were all in the mix zone after the game on Saturday when Leverkusen, I think, took the lead and then possibly went 2-0 up against Bayern. And you know, we got to talking about how Spurs fans might feel or should feel or would feel if Kane won nothing. You know, I said it would be, you know, for me, a kind of great story, I guess is the right way to put it. For kind of full clarity, I really like and respect Harry Kane. And, you know, I have described him many times in my articles and on here as Spurs' greatest ever player. So I certainly would think Kane deserves to win something. But football for me is about, you know, storylines and kind of great narratives as much as it is about, you know, the game itself, the action itself. And I think Kane leaving Spurs in the summer for a side who had won 11 straight Bundesliga titles and were about as sure a thing as you could possibly pick in the whole of Europe to win a league. Because Real Madrid have competition from Barca and Atletico, I guess. And even Paris Saint-Germain haven't wrapped it up every year since their Qatari takeover. So Bayern were a sure thing. For him to leave Spurs for that club and then not win the league, them not to win the league for the first time in 12 seasons, despite Kane having this absurd kind of record-breaking, ridiculous start, I think is clearly a really interesting storyline. It's, you know, there's a kind of deep irony in that. And I think that, you know, that's really interesting. And I guess there would be an element of like schadenfreude in that in kind of, and finding it quite funny. But that's not because I want to see Kane miserable. It's difficult to explain. It's just because it would be such a strange turnout. And I don't think Kane's cursed. I just think there would be a kind of deep irony that we could all appreciate, surely, in that being the way this unfolded. Not to mention that Leverkusen winning the German League is you know, objectively good for football and good for German football. You know, no one wants to see a team win the league 12 seasons in a row. It's boring. It's a monopoly, and it's, you know, it's unhealthy. So that is obviously a good thing for the German game.
Well, yeah, okay, but I don't really care about the German game. I care about Harry Kane, who did everything for Spurs, and I want him. I mean, he does deserve to win some silverware. I was thinking back to other players who, I mean, if they're not cursed, have at least been very unfortunate in terms of not winning much. I mean, Shearer didn't win very much, and I was thinking of Gary Lineker, actually, so I've just looked up his record, because clearly he played for some big, big teams, and in the end, he did win the cup with us. He won a couple of charity shields. And at Barcelona, although he didn't have the happiest of times there under Johan Cruyff, he was part of the team that won the Cup Winners' Cup and the Copa del Rey. So he got his hands on some silverware. I personally think, Tom, it would be, I don't want to use, well, in sporting terms, it would be a tragedy if Harry Kane didn't have at least one trophy to sit and look at from his comfy chair when he finally hangs up his boots.
Yeah, I mean, I think he will, to be honest. You know, even if they don't win it this year, they'll probably win it next year. And even if they don't win the league, they might win the Champions League. You know, Bayern don't go through 2 or 3 years without winning a fair share of trophies. But I take Dan's point that if Bayern don't win the league, it's always a huge story. And if they don't win it the first season that Kane turns up there, then, you know, there is a huge amount of irony. I guess the problem for Spurs fans is that I don't think it's really a win either way, because if Kane wins the league there, then they get stick from everyone saying, you know, I mean, you remember the first game he played, didn't he, in that, whatever it was the German Super Cup or whatever, you know, and, you know, everyone was ready to say, you know, that, oh, look, Kane's won, you know, a trophy within his first 24 hours and he couldn't do it within 20 years at Spurs, you know, so it doesn't work. That doesn't work well for Tottenham. It doesn't particularly work well if he doesn't win anything, because then everyone says, well, look, he's, you know, he's Spursy till the end or whatever. So it doesn't, there's no win here, in my opinion, for Tottenham, apart from Kane just getting back to Hotspur Way as quickly as possible and everyone kind of forgetting about it. I just think on a personal note, I have huge admiration for Kane and what he did at Spurs. And I admit that I also have a little bit of sympathy for him, for having to endure, you know, a lot of the nonsense that went on for 10 years. And that, you know, that's not to say he didn't play his part in that. You know, that's a different debate. All, there are lots of finals he didn't turn up in. You know, there are some games he should have done better in, et cetera, et cetera. He is part of that. But he also had to kind of, you know, endure Nuno and you know, the Mourinho thing and, you know, Spurs not buying the right players at the end of the 2019, you know, Champions League final. Like, you know, we know all this. And Kane, throughout those years, was an amazing, amazing player all the way through. And it's worth saying right now that he scored 28 goals in 28 games for Bayern. Like, this is no reflection on his season. He's probably going to break the Bundesliga record, for example. So from a personal point of view, I just kind of think he deserves it. You know, he deserves to win cups. And I mean, there are a lot of sportsmen who, you know, it doesn't work out for, I guess. You know, it reminds me of quite Andy Murray, you know, who should have won, you know, loads of Grand Slams, but couldn't because they just fell kind of in the wrong era or whatever. So I'm not saying just because, you know, deserve is a strong word, I think, in football and all sports, because, you know, you can be an amazing player and it doesn't necessarily mean everything works out perfectly. But I just think from a Spurs point of view, I guess I'm surprised that so many people are kind of, you know, like Dan, wishing badly on someone who was an amazing player and an amazing servant for the club for so long.
Yeah, I feel I should make it clear that I'm really not wishing anything but the best for Kane. It's a difficult one to articulate, really, because I think the kind of crux of it is that it would just be so kind of ironic if Kane smashed every Bundesliga record and went to the most successful dominant team in Germany and then didn't win anything his first season, that I think there would just be something almost quite funny about it. But equally, it's not funny in that, ha ha ha, let's all laugh at Harry Kane, like, you know, Arsenal fans have done over the years. Yeah, a difficult one to articulate, but I certainly kind of understand why there are fans sort of, you know, across the spectrum, not just Spurs fans, kind of invested in sort of seeing Leverkusen win the league. I think there are lots of different levels that make that a good story, and one of them is clearly Kane.
Well, it's inevitable. That's the nature of football and those who follow it. I think when the history of the 21st century football silverware anthology is written, there should be a revised view on the Audi Cup of whatever year it was, because actually I think that was a really significant tournament in hindsight. So he's always got that Audi Cup replica trophy to look at if it all goes horribly wrong, which it might. Just quickly before we go, Wolves at the weekend, guys. They've beaten us in three of the last four Premier League meetings between the two sides. Why is that? And Tom, how dangerous might they be as they lick their wounds following a home defeat to Brentford last weekend?
Yeah, I don't know why that is. I think Wolves are a funny team. They're one of these sort of teams in the Premier League that can be quite dangerous. I think they are well organised. I like Gary O'Neill. I think I think they're a difficult team to break down. I think that's always been their thing. But actually, in more recent months, they have actually become slightly more expansive as well. They get kind of good results occasionally. You know, not just the Chelsea one, but they went away and won 4-1 at Brentford at the end of last year, I think. They beat Man City earlier in the season back in September. They're a bit of a sort of an awkward fish for some of the bigger clubs. So I don't think this will be an easy game. But this is an important run for Tottenham. You know, we know that Manchester United are suddenly gaining momentum and sort of belief, you know, suddenly thinking, you know, we could get into the top four even. And I think it's important that Tottenham kind of just keep that gap, you know, because if they give United too much encouragement, then they could be, you know, involved in a three-way race. So, and Spurs have got some decent fixtures now. You know, this is their sort of this run of three home games. I think if they can keep the United sort of distance, then I think they'll be fine. I actually think they're now in a really strong position for the top four. Aston Villa wavering. They've got Europe coming up. A few injuries now kicking in at Villa, which they haven't had all season. And as we know, Spurs have now got their best team available. And I think this is the moment when they have to really kick on. And I think almost be a bit ruthless here in their season management. You know, I think we talked about when they had so many injuries, kind of staying in it and hanging tight. And I thought they did that really well. And now I think they just have to kind of push the foot on the accelerator a bit and just be ruthless and just put Villa and United away and let them scrap it out for fifth.
They've been really effective at kind of halting periods of momentum from memory. I mean, I think their first win against Spurs was over Conte's team. I think it was around February 2022. So Spurs were just beginning to find a bit of rhythm and get up to speed. Then they had that week where they lost at home, I think, to Southampton and Wolves back-to-back. I can't remember the order, but it was a really disappointing performance. And after that week, you just thought, well, Spurs aren't going to do anything this season. And actually, they really clicked into gear after that and went on a great run and obviously got fourth. And then last year, from memory, it was when Stellini was in the dugout and it was 0-0 at Molineux. And I think there was this period where Conte was kind of on his sick bed, sort of sending instructions through to Stellini. And I think we all thought he had basically sent instructions through saying, hold out for the 0-0. And Spurs made some quite defensive changes towards the end. I seem to remember Lucas came on possibly for Son or someone like that, or Kulusevski, and Traore scored pretty soon after. And it was a bit of a late sucker punch. And then obviously the defeat in November was right after the Chelsea game, when Spurs had just kind of lost half their team in one match. You know, Maddison and Van de Ven to injury, Udogi and Romero to suspension. And it was a really kind of wounded and depleted Spurs going to Molineux. I think it was Dier's only start under Big Ange. So a very good time to play Spurs for Wolves. And then when we all kind of remember what happened, Spurs went 1-0 up and then conceded twice in extra time after dropping deeper and deeper and deeper toward their own goal. So Wolves have been a bit of a bogey team. I think they have probably played Spurs at good times, but they've kind of proved very effective at halting sort of encouraging periods, even under Stellini, who I think had, you know, a very strong start, you know, won two or three of his first games, including against City. And then went to Wolves, just as we were thinking Christian Stellini was kind of the next coming of Mourinho or something. Wolves put an end to that.
Dan, I think deluded as we Spurs fans are, and one result can make a lot of difference, I don't think we deep down ever really thought that Christian Stellini was going to be the second coming But
well, speak for yourself, mate. We were all aboard the Cellini hype train for a bit.
Oh dear!
I was actually sitting next to for that Wolves game. I remember now that there were loads of people in the press box, and I sort of wanted a bit more space, so I kind of went up a couple of rows, and I was sitting next to Conte's brother, Gianluca, is it? Gianluca Conte, I think. And so he was basically up in the stands, basically doing the kind of job of seeing the whole pitch. And he was obviously in contact with Antonio, who I think must have been in Italy or whatever. He was recovering, wasn't he, Antonio, from his surgery?
Had his gallbladder out, had he? Yeah.
Gallbladder, that's it. And so he was, and then he was, I just remember him at the end, he was sort of shouting down, not shouting down, but he was communicating to Stellini through his, whatever it was, little mic. And he was just saying, Lucas now. And this was like in the 85th minute or whatever. And they did bring on Lucas, but Wolves scored, I think, maybe just before or just after. So I don't know how or why there was so much urgency to get Lucas on for Kulusevski. You know, it was a real insight into... I can imagine Antonio was sort of in Italy kind of jumping up and down on his sofa, like, get Lucas on immediately to see out this 0-0 draw at Molineux.
So I'm just having a look now. So, yeah, Lucas came on for Kulusevski in the 77th minute.
There you go.
And then Emerson came on for Porro, and Spurs immediately conceded after that. So, yeah, I seem to remember he was trying to lock down the right side where Traore was causing a bit of havoc. So on came Emerson for Porro, and then a minute later Traore scored. So not the kind of masterstroke Cellini and Conte hoped it would be.
Galling times for all of us as Conte recovered from his gallbladder issues, but that's in the past. I've got to say, guys, I just so look forward to going to Spurs matches, and I haven't felt like this for a really long time. And of course, we'll have more disappointments, but it's just I am like a kid again. I am counting the days down because there's a buzz there. You know, you're going to get some exciting football. Probably going to have a dramatic moment in stoppage time. It's wonderful. And another friend of mine who's just got his very first season ticket, and he's a relatively advanced age. He's so proud, actually, because he's got corporate hospitality as well. And he arrives at 11:55. I think the doors open at 12 o'clock. He beetles up and he eats everything under the sun that's available. And wonderful menu. I don't know quite which restaurant he dines in. And he's like a kid as well. It's fantastic. Long may it continue. Boys, thank you very much indeed. It's an important game coming up because, as we've mentioned, Wolves are tough. But if Spurs can win and take full advantage of this succession of home games with Crystal Palace to follow, poor old Mr. Roy. Thought he was going to do a job for us against Chelsea last night. Not to be. But this is a fascinating stage in the season. So thanks to Tom Allnutt of The Times. Thank you to Dan Kilpatrick of The Evening Standard, who will now pen a letter of apology to Harry Kane for reveling in his current discomfort in Germany. I'm Marcus Buckland. Come on, you Spurs.